This reading comes from Frederick Douglass, and it's from a speech that has been called now, "If there is no struggle, there is no progress." Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are people who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its waters. The struggle may be a moral one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. My third year of seminary, the Occupy Wall Street movement took off. And author and activist Cornel West was one of our professors, and he said, "You get a free pass, you don't have to go to class, you don't have to turn in assignments, just go down to Zuccotti Park, spend as much time as you can." And he would tell us that we were learning to be preachers and pastors, but to not forget that we should also be prophets. And I remember seeing this larger-than-life man down there with a megaphone late at night saying in beautiful, moving words why we were doing this. The experience was exhilarating. We'd go down every afternoon and night and see this growing village of tents and sleeping bags, people sharing food and conversation. And it felt like this movement I just wanted to throw myself into fully and not look back. Finally, after studying social justice day in and day out, I could finally be part of the fight on the ground. I could experience it firsthand. I could participate in something meaningful. And as the weeks went on, there was more and more talk about how evil the 1% was. This faceless mass of corruption and greed. Occupy Wall Streeters even threw things or screamed at wealthy people as they were leaving their homes or returning from work. And I began to feel less comfortable with this movement I was supporting with my words and actions. Were we tearing down oppression? Or gathering to voice a collective dehumanization of rich people? Did we really want to do something, or did we just feel good to complain while we were actually being listened to? And I began to feel lost and unsettled and unsure if I was doing the right thing, and eventually I stopped going. And I've often struggled with this experience, looking back. Did I choose to stand up for the full humanity of all? Or did I leave a meaningful fight the moment things got a little confusing or messy? Was I more afraid of offending the powerful than I was committed to being an ally of the oppressed? Was I too busy to give a darn about any struggle that didn't involve writing my master's thesis? Probably all of the above. But telling you the choice that I made makes my stomach turn because I'm ashamed of it. Because I think of all of the dilemmas and complications set aside by every prophet in history who eventually made a difference. And I realized that I wanted crops without plowing the ground. I wanted rain without thunder and lightning. I wanted the ocean without the awful roar of its waters. Growing up Unitarian Universalist, I always heard about two great men who had shaped our faith. One was William Ellery Channing, and the other was Theodore Parker. Channing was a kind man, very much beloved by many in the mid-1800s. After college, Channing had an experience of living with a wealthy slave-owning family in Virginia before going to seminary. And Channing loved the hospitality and the warmth of these southern hosts, But he also wrote in a letter home, "There is one object here which always depresses me. It is slavery. This alone would prevent me from ever settling in Virginia. Language cannot express my detestation of it. Master and slave, nature never made such a distinction or established such a relation." Channing believed human nature was in the image of God. He believed that if we pushed ourselves and had a disciplined spiritual practice, we could reach the perfection exemplified by a human Jesus. Channing was disgusted by how brutally slavery degraded the sacredness of human life. But after seminary, while William Ellery Channing served as a minister in Boston, he was loved and supported by Boston's wealthy and socially comfortable. And it took well over a decade for him to speak out publicly against slavery. Channing so feared that people like his Virginia friends would feel villainized and dehumanized into a faceless mass. He was unwilling to join the abolitionist movement because of this. He saw the abolitionists as, quote, harsh speaking, confrontational, poorly educated, and self-righteous. Not the kind of people that someone of his refined New England upbringing would associate with. For years, Channing joined the anti-slavery folks who were all for changing laws slowly getting rid of slavery in the United States, but were not going to encourage uprisings or overnight change. They wanted the rain very much, but not the thunder or the lightning. And I've shared with you before, Channing only joined the abolitionist movement after his Unitarian friend Lydia Maria Child spent years of intense conversation and letter writing trying to persuade him. And finally, she got tired of waiting for him to speak up, and she spoke up herself. In 1833, she wrote an appeal in favor of that class of Americans called Africans, which argued that slavery degrades the humanity of slaves and slaveholders alike, and essentially should have ended yesterday. And then there's Theodore Parker. Parker was 30 years younger than Channing. Growing up, I loved hearing stories about how Theodore Parker would write sermons with a pistol on his desk. While large crowds of people supported Parker, he also had a lot of enemies. And that was because he was one of the founders of the Vigilance Committee in Boston, a group of black and white citizens who worked together against the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which you may recall legally required Northerners to help capture escaped slaves and return them to slaveholders in the South. So Parker led this group of vigilantes who followed these so-called slave catchers and intimidated them and kept them from completing their mission. Parker also housed fugitive slaves in his own home. Over the years, Parker stood trial for inciting an abolitionist riot in Boston and for his active efforts to keep federal marshals from their work enforcing the Fugitive Slave Act. Parker also helped finance John Brown's efforts to raid the armory in Harper's Ferry, Virginia, to get weapons to arm abolitionists, militias, and arm slaves for uprisings. When John Brown was arrested, Theodore Parker published a public letter defending Brown's actions and arguing that slaves had the right to kill their masters. So whether or not he was comfortable with thunder and lightning and the roar of the ocean, Parker embraced the bloody struggle for justice. For Channing, there were great complexities and gray area involved in the fight for justice and equality. There's no gray area for Parker. He was prepared to live, die, kill, and support killing to end slavery. For Parker, the ends justify the means. Doesn't matter how you do it as long as slavery ends. For Channing, the end goal was carrying out the means with compassion. And I think to make sense of the prophethood of these two men, we should turn to the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. In his letter from a Birmingham jail, King said, "So I have tried to make it clear that it is wrong to use immoral means to attain moral ends. It's not okay to kill to end slavery. But now I must affirm that it is just as wrong, or even more so, to use moral means to preserve immoral ends, to recognize all of humanity in order to preserve slavery. That's also not okay." Prophets call us to feel what the oppressed feel. Prophets call us to see the struggle of others as our own. Prophets live and die for people and ideals greater than themselves. Their goal is not to tread lightly or be liked. Whether or not Occupy Wall Street was the perfect movement, I now see that my task was to stand up to the institution of Wall Street, which creates nothing and takes everything. I now see that it takes the resources, as we learned this week, of 3.6 billion of the world's poorest to equal the amount of money the 8 richest men in the world have. 3.6 billion compared to 8 people. And I see now that my task was to witness to the fact that astronomical income inequality degrades the humanity of the poor and the most wealthy alike. And as I believe fervently in nurturing and protecting the inherent worth and dignity of all people, I have to sit with and hear and act on the call of the prophet in my heart. I think that the test of a true prophet is that they make us uncomfortable. Maybe their living commitment teaches us that we will have to plow the soil in order to grow the crops. Maybe it's because prophets awaken some fire in us, some understanding that we too could live and die for others if we really wanted to. We could see suffering and recognize our own flesh and blood. Each of us has an inner prophet. Yours might be peaceful and tenacious. Yours might be fiery and uncompromising. Your inner prophet may be fueled by love or rage or a combination. But we all have an inner prophet sitting somewhere in the neighborhood of our heart and our conscience. Unitarian Universalist theologian James Luther Adams didn't believe that clergy alone were called to be prophets. He taught that every Unitarian Universalist must live their lives in the divine tension between love and justice. To paraphrase Adams, only through the propheticism of all Unitarian Universalists can we together make history instead of merely being pushed around by it. I think this is true, that all great prophets live in the tension between love and justice. I think great prophets avoid violence, but not the willingness to put their lives on the line. Great prophets don't dehumanize entire groups of people, but they do hold them accountable. To do prophetic work as Unitarian Universalists, we must embrace thunder and lightning alongside the rain. We must embrace the roar of the ocean along with its waters. If we want to know the answer to, well, what do I do with all this? How do I live prophetically in the midst of a comfortable life? The answer is in remembering that the suffering of others is our suffering, and the struggle of others is our struggle. Blessed be. Amen.